so you don't have to worry about it.
I did the same thing with my abs.
They're tattooed.
Ready?
That's actually turned into a thing, is celebrities getting stuff airbrushed on their bodies for photo ops. And I guess there was one that was really, really bad. There was some actress that had a bigger boob line airbrushed onto her chest for an awards ceremony, but there was something that was wrong with it. Like, her dress line sunk like an inch and a half below the airbrushing, so it's airbrush, airbrush, stop.
She was an optical illusion.
Exactly. Oh,
a boob-lusion.
Is that like a person wearing those camouflage sneakers and they look like they're floating?
I think we've digressed.
A yes. little bit.
Stamp collectors are such big geeks, we also talk about boobs.
And since we're talking about things meant to deceive, and we have a Navy man here, in World War I, the Germans would name their ships after jokes so the British couldn't see them.
Hmm.
Oh.
Thank you, B. Rye.
Okay, let's count it down now.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Hello there, this is Chad Snee. I'm the editor of Lynn Stamp News and the Scott Publishing Company, and you're listening to Stamp Show Here Today.
It's hard to send up. It's hard to send up.
Welcome to Stamp Show Here Today, episode 33. I'm sitting here with Scott, Cash, Lloyd, and Jeff, and I'm your host, Jessica.
And always remember, stamp collecting happens when we dream together.
That's a really good point. No, wait, that's just a stupid string of words.
You can find us on Facebook at Stamp Show Here Today and on Twitter at Stamp Show HT. Tell your friends they can find us on iTunes, Podbay, and Stitcher. Let's talk about stamps. So this week we'll be talking about stamp news, the 1 cent magenta goes on tour, and the post office overcharges on a national level. Hashtag stamp stories, where do illegible letters go, and words I can't say, I'm sure.
Illegible. Illegible.
Illegible.
Dirigible.
start with that hashtag thing real quick.
I'll keep it all in.
Oh boy.
Hashtag stamp stories, where do illegible letters go? And our expert topic of the week is all about fakes and forgeries.
Wow, I was going to pop in a Best of Queen CD, but I think I'll listen to this. Go on, what else do we got?
We are the champions, my friend.
Tweet, tweet.
Careful, I'm going to have to pay somebody for that.
Hey, it was less than 9 notes.
Okay.
We're fine.
And it's Jeff, so if we actually had Freddie Mercury bust in the door and start singing, I think we'd have a problem.
Zombie Mercury.
Yeah, that would be...
I don't know.
So stamp news, the British 1 cent magenta goes on tour. It's going to be on tour for the next several years, actually. And it's going to start its tour at the William Gross Postal Gallery in D.C. And then on to Monaco. And then it's going to end up for its grand finale at the New York 2016 show. So does anybody know who owns this thing yet?
Not officially.
Not officially.
How about unofficially? Does anybody have
Well, we have speculation.
Well, I'm sure the guy who owns it knows he owns it.
Oh, there we go.
And who's delivered it to him knows he owns it.
I would almost bet that it wasn't a person.
The guy who processed his
it.
Payment. Probably knows who owns
yeah.
it.
Well, it's interesting because the thing that threw me for a loop is that, okay, it's going to go to D.C. and it's going to go to New York, but it's going to be in Monaco. Why would anybody give a rat's tail about Monaco unless they were from there and they were showing their stamp in their home country?
Monaco has a very large and very popular stamp exhibiting community.
Okay.
They have, I mean, if you look for like, stamps on stamps, probably like half the stamps are going to be from Monaco. They advertise heavily their stamp shows. They get the best exhibits that are interesting, you know, not the fly specky stuff, but the really cool stuff.
Like roach exhibits?
Yeah, it's like, you know, our 2016 coming up. They have one of those every year.
Hmm.
Oh, cool. Oh, that means it's going to be the 2016 New York show. We actually might have a chance to see it.
Ooh. Yeah.
Ooh.
Oh, yeah. On June 4, 2015, the owner will reveal himself in public and will finally know who owns the thing.
Hmm. That'll be interesting. Because, like I said,
I hope they arrest him.
For what?
Why?
Revealing himself.
Oh. God, I fell right into that one.
I don't think it's a trench coat kind of situation. I think it's a red curtain and him holding up the stamp behind the curtain, and they pull the curtain back, and they go, ta-da!
Hey, lady, want to see my stamps?
And it'll be Oprah or somebody.
Oh, good grief, I hope not.
Oh, yeah. So, if anyone went to the post office this week, they might have noticed that they were overcharged on their postage.
Huh?
Yeah.
Didn't hear about that one? Yeah.
It was a computer glitch. The new rates weren't supposed to take effect until May 31st. But the person that programmed the computer programmed them in to go into effect much sooner. So, yeah. If you bring your receipt back there and say, hey, what's going on here, they will refund you.
How much was the overcharge?
Well,
the difference in the rates between the current rate and the new one that's taking effect on the 31st.
Yeah.
But the new rate is going to be 49 cents, isn't it?
No. Like if you mailed a 2-ounce letter, it's supposed to be 70. You got charged 71 cents, so go back and get your penny.
That would actually be pretty cool to get some of that as postal history then, because that would be improper late rate properly used.
Well, you have until the 31st when it's supposed to be official. If you actually want to go down and pursue that, you could try.
Well, I guess...
Well, I'm sure they've already corrected it, though.
Yeah, they've already corrected it, I'm
sure. Sort of. Only by hand.
Yes. If you go to a postage rate machine, it will overcharge you.
Yes.
Oh. But if you go to a person, they can't use their computers anymore. They have to figure it out by hand.
So you might be able to get it out of a machine somehow purpose.
We can make overcharged commemorative covers with a overcharged cachet on it.
Excellent.
That's something for me to do tomorrow. I'm gonna write that down and see if I can do one.
So yeah, if you can get mail through that does not involve a human, anything that's a machine, you'll be able to get it at a mixed up rate.
When did you read this? I mean,
this started yesterday on the previous. No, today, this Wednesday, today, the 27th.
So this is a brand new article coming out.
Absolutely.
Right. Cool. So if I can crank one or two out now, I could get this error.
You get it on the day it happened if you got one in there today.
First day of issue of the incorrect rate.
Correct. So you have to pay the regular forever is still 49 cents, but you'd have to get one of the extra stamps that's going to have a rate change.
2-ounce or priority or something. And then put a confused computer on the cachet and you'll be good to go.
Yep.
That's a good picture. Yeah. a confused computer with improper rate charge. But yeah, next podcast, people will be able to see it.
We'll give one away.
Yeah, we'll give it away.
Okay, so for our hashtag Sam Stories, I finally figured out where Cash's mail was going before he got a label maker. It took some serious digging, but there is a place where illegible letters get banished. Well, not really banished, get sorted through.
Well, they get banished to then and then get sorted. Oh, they go there first. That's like banishment.
It's like purgatory for letters.
There you go.
There we go. Since the world has not yet invented a robot capable of reading crappy handwriting, a team of the finest postal workers in the United States tolls day and night in an effort to deliver the most indecipherable of mail. Tucked away in a nondescript parking lot on the outskirts of Salt Lake City is the United States Postal Service Remote Encoding Center. There's a fancy name for you. All day, every day, workers sit at specialized stations as monitors present scanned pieces of correspondence with questionable addresses scrawled on the envelopes. Shifts last 8 hours, and the employees are trained to take 10 seconds or less on each piece of mail as it whizzes on their screen. It's their job to make an educated guess as to the intent of the sender before shuffling the once questionable piece of mail along on its route of delivery. In the age of declining penmanship, More than 5 million pieces of mail pass under its roof every day. It seems absurd that this would be the only place in the nation where unreadable mail is deciphered. Yet all but one of these specialized mail centers was closed over the years. This makes the Salt Lake Depot the last hope for postal customers with shoddy handwriting. Put it simply, if you have poor penmanship, all your mail passes through here without exception. Maybe consider clearly addressing a thank you note to the folks inside one of these days.
So does that mean if I live in Maine and I go to mail something to my neighbor three blocks down and they can't read the handwriting, they send it all the way to Salt Lake City, process it, and send it all the way back, and then come to my house and slap me?
Well, that's assuming, of course, that they can read it and get it to your neighbor.
Just illegible enough.
Yeah, but wait a minute. Maybe they, you know, they scan every piece of mail that goes through. They take a picture of it.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe they send a picture to Salt Lake City.
Touche. So they send images.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I don't think they send the actual mail
there. The age of
there.
Technology here.
Maybe they used to send it there.
That might have been why they had to close some of them.
Yeah. So tell us what you think about this practice at hashtag Sam Story, hashtag illegible letters.
I wonder if they type it in illegibly.
That would take some work.
It would
take a really bad typewriter.
They'd send it to Salt Lake City and go, oh, this is what they meant.
So this is a recession-proof business here. As long as we still have hands that write,
This
will still exist.
Probably.
One postal job they can't get out by machines.
One of these days it's going to be a problem just if somebody still writes in cursive. Give it 20 years.
Yeah, no kidding.
They don't, from what I understand, they don't teach kids cursive writing in elementary school anymore, do they?
A bit.
A little bit?
Yeah.
I went to write in cursive about a week ago, and I had to think about it. It was weird.
I went to write, and I had to think about it. I don't write anything anymore.
Nope.
Not in college anymore. I don't take notes. And even when I was in college, I typed them out. So.
Well, personally, I'd have to double my efforts to just be half-assed about this.
Okay, cute. So updates. Cash, what do you have for us today?
I have I went on three websites that this relates to last week's conversation about the Columbian Exposition.
Because he couldn't read just one.
Yeah. And the San Francisco Archives has a great map of the Columbian Exposition, where the promenade is and where all the buildings are, things like that. And then you can pull up on Google Maps what it looks like today. And all the buildings are gone except for one. The Fine Arts Building became the Museum of Science and Industry. But all the rest is very interesting because they kept where all the waterways were. They basically turned the whole thing into a park. And it's very, very neat to see then versus today. And then at the Library.University of Chicago, they have a very nice layout, which is at eye level, which shows you what the buildings all look like, and you can click on them and see what they all are. Just a really, it was very interesting to me to get a little bit more in depth on what we discussed last week. The second thing was Dawn was here, and she enjoyed being on the podcast last week, even though she only said about 10 words. And she brought you a present.
Okay, it's in a small little bag, and there's tons of paper.
Oh, no. Yeah, I should have guessed.
It's a Hello Kitty rocking a tutu, and it's pink and black, and it's pretty awesome. Thank you, Dawn. I guess we can call her a super fan, can't we?
She's sending you gifts.
Our resident super fan. Well, every podcast
send us money
has
and you
super
can be
fans.
A super fan too.
Well, we're actually going to start that's a good point, Lloyd. We're starting a funding campaign. They built it in. The company that's gracious enough to host our podcast called Podbean added it as a feature to their site that's free. So we'll actually do that. We're planning it right now where you send us $5, you get this. You send us $20, you get this.
Well, see, I would really like to get some of the stamp dealers to just, you know, here's $20, mention me on the podcast, and we'll say, this even if, you know, this guy is a great stamp dealer, one of the best we know, buy all his stamps and ignore his rap sheet.
Yeah, no, one of the one of the cheaper levels we thought of, like 10 or 20 bucks you get mentioned. Higher, you can get yourself a rotating, long-standing ad.
Yeah.
So. 100,000, you get a nice thank you card from Barbados.
And a signed headshot of Cash.
Exactly.
Send me a quarter and I'll say hi.
Shout outs, quarter. Okay, so a little something I have for updates. Over the weekend, we went to a new Hobby Lobby built in good old Redlands, California. We discovered they actually have a stamp collecting section. Yes, I can get my stamp on every day of the week now.
Oh.
Except on Sundays.
Yeah, except on Sundays. Oh. And you can't buy your birth control there.
Oh, well.
If that's your hobby.
Oh, boy.
But this is the Hobby Lobby. I mean.
Yeah, you can do that. You need a room. Don't do it in the lobby.
So what do they sell there?
I mean, you can purchase supplies like albums, loops, tongs, cards, mounts, and more. They have several stamp mix pouches available for purchase, including regular U.S., regular international, premium U.S., and several different packs of topical collections. I purchased a pack of topical collection labeled Indians, which is one of my areas of interest, and I'll open it really quick.
Oh.
And I'll post a picture of what's in it. Like a
drum roll.
So this was...
So... It's a gigantic packet.
How much was it?
Because the sticker's on the front of the plastic. It was cheap.
$3.49.
It is like 6 inches by 6 inches. Yeah. It's produced by H.E. Harris Company.
Yeah.
At the bottom.
It costs $3.49. It has 14 stamps in it. So what's the breakdown on these?
Are they mint or used?
Used.
Oh, they're all used. And the difference while she's getting them out that we saw, they offer a premium U.S. and a regular U.S. Regular is like used modern, like ultra modern, like 80s and 90s.
And premium, you'll have premium. U.S. number ones and...
No.
Yeah, you know, it's where they have like the 299s and stuff. No, it's like all 3 cent commemoratives and stuff in the premium. But the premium's only like $6. It's good for kids, that's for sure.
Yeah, that's a nice little mix for Indian stamps. I mean,
there's some 3 cents.
Oh, it's got a 1 cent Colombian is the earliest thing.
There's a 1 cent Colombian.
Ooh.
Yeah. Yeah.
Is it centered?
It's pretty good, actually.
Yeah. Can we grade it?
That would be awesome. That's got to be two.
I did not know there were Indians in this one. It's the Stephen Watts Kearney Expedition, 1946.
What does that have to do with?
There's some Indians in the background. I just saw them.
It was a fort for the U.S. Army.
Yeah, it was, and down in San Diego.
Soldiers and some Indians. I did not know that was Indians.
We started to discover any stamp that has to do with an expedition or a landing or a discovery has a chance of having an Indian on it. Yeah. A lot of them do.
Oh, totally off the subject. Anybody out there who gets Netflix, Turn is a really, really cool show about... General Washington Spy Network.
You finally discovered that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we crammed through it too. It took us like 3 nights to watch them all. And but they have the guy John Rogers, and he's got his Indian guide behind him.
Ooh.
So they're all used, and one of them is actually really cruddy. It has a piece of a stamp stuck to the back.
And, it was $3.50. What do you expect?
The perfs are not so hot.
Well,
I probably won't buy another one.
Well, admittedly, you know, it's probably for people who really don't collect stamps.
They had some decent supplies. It was about as extensive as like one of the supply dealers at a show.
And there's only 13 stamps in here.
Hold on. Doesn't it say there's 24?
It says there's 14.
Oh, 14?
And I only got 13.
Oh, there's 14.
Oh, 13.
They
owe
me
pack.
A stamp.
Oh, what about the one that's stuck to the back?
That's probably number 14.
That's a partial.
I got 13 and a half stamps. I'm going to call them
I beg to differ. I don't think that was a half a stamp. I think that was less.
Yeah, there's 13.
Yeah, you're not counting wrong.
I see it too.
H.E. Harris & Co., you owe me a stamp.
Yep. I am going to look at that Colombian later. That's funny.
Okay. So, listener questions. We didn't have any this week.
Oh, no. Forgot to look.
Well, that would be
I have something lame. That we just produced.
Okay, we'll do Cash's normal.
Cash's weird
Thing
of the week.
For those of you who know the narwhal song or have anybody in your family who is less than, let's say, the age of 15, you're going to know the narwhal song.
Or college students.
We made a little, we found, when I was going through.
Don't say we.
Okay, I. I was going through a large group of Canadian stamps, and I found a Canadian stamp with a narwhal on it. So I made little narwhal collectible slabs.
I purposely didn't tell you that they had a narwhal stamp.
You knew this would happen.
And the flips, one of them says, because they are so awesome, and the other one says, the Jedi of the Sea. And for anybody who doesn't know the song...
No.
What?
No.
I don't know what you're talking about.
YouTube.
That's the one.
Back to stamp collecting.
It's stamp related.
There's a stamp.
Yeah. It's a stamp. I'm holding a stamp in my hand right now that has to do with narwhals.
Yeah, and all of our listeners can see that.
Yep.
Here, I'll hold it up to the microphone.
if you're a topical stamp collector,
Kaz, you're
going
to have to spend 5 minutes
narwhals.
In the penalty box now.
Yeah, Brian, what do you think?
That was very humorous and informative.
Thank you very much.
Using his name in vain at this point.
I don't think he listens to these anymore if he's just letting us rip off his voice.
No, actually, he's getting really busy right now, but he did say that he will come in and do some more.
Ooh, we'll get some more stamp tips out of him.
Yep, some more of the bumpers.
Okay, so this week our expert topic is Fakes and Forgeries Part 1. And it's not to be confused with, what was it, what was confusing about it?
Counterfeits. There's a difference.
So what is the difference between a fake, a forgery, and a counterfeit?
What are y'all looking at me for?
Well, it's written.
You want me to read it?
Yeah.
A fake is anything that is not real, basically. Counterfeits and forgeries both fit. A forgery is used to duplicate something in any way. Usually done in an attempt to deceive either the collector or for monetary gain. Counterfeit is a forgery with a different intent. It's trying to pass off a fake as something that's real. So you can have a forgery where you can just hand draw it and it won't fool anybody. That's still a forgery. But it's not really a counterfeit until you try and make money with it.
A fake might be if you cut out a picture from an auction catalog and mounted it in your album.
Oh, yeah.
That would be a fake.
Or posted it on an envelope.
No, if you post it on an envelope, then it's a counterfeit.
That's a counterfeit.
Then it would be a counterfeit.
Right.
Yeah.
Because a counterfeit is with the intent to defraud a larger group like the government in this case.
You can look at fakes.
Counterfeit is to fool the person that made the original.
Good way to put it, to fool the person that made the original or the group. Okay.
Yeah, the difference between counterfeiting and faking and forging is intent in the law. And if you have the intent to use the item for the express use, then it's a counterfeit. Like if you counterfeit a $5 bill and then try to spend it, you're counterfeiting. If you just made a $5 bill and then put it in a frame on the wall somewhere, then you're just faking and forging.
Now, one question I had, and this comes from nitpicking a little bit from when we collected pins, because this is a big argument there, too, because they had different versions of this. So for stamps in our community, one thing we see a lot are stamps that have been altered. So what's the difference, then, between a forgery and an altered stamp? Because we all authenticate altered stamps, but not forgeries.
An altered stamp would be a fake.
Well, that's not true.
A real stamp.
We'll authenticate a forgery.
Authenticate it, correct.
Or a counterfeit. Because, jumping ahead a little bit, yes, some of them are. There are some very famous fakes and forgeries that are actually worth a fair amount of money. They're not just stuff that you would throw in the garbage and consider worthless.
But then that's something that was instead made from scratch versus say something altered would be a stamp where like the perfs have been cut off or something
generally,
of that nature,
yes.
Like fake coils would be altered stamps.
Right. Yes. You would fake a coil. You would forge if you like made the entire stamp. And if you stuck it on an envelope and tried to pass it through the mail, then you'd be counterfeiting.
Aren't they worth more if they make it through the mail?
Oh, yeah.
If it's
yeah.
a famous counterfeiter?
Yeah. So what all has been faked? Well, as far as stamp collectors are concerned, the stamps have been faked.
Well, as far as stamps and are being, all stamps have
but,
been...
but not just the stamps. The gum can be faked. Right. The printing of the stamp can be faked. The cancel on a stamp can be faked. And then you move into postal history and you have covers that are faked. They can either be complete fabrications or they can have alterations done to them, adding stamps, taking away stamps, adding markings.
Which we had an example of that today, Scott.
I was thinking about that.
Tell them about your cover you found.
Oh, I had found a cover in a large ephemera lot that I bought, and I've been throwing that stuff up on eBay because I don't collect it. And it was from the Wilkins Ellsworth Arctic expedition in 1931. And I did not know that they had been extensively faked. And after I had listed it up on eBay, and the genuine covers are worth anywhere from 75 to 100 and a quarter. So they're not inexpensive. And somebody on eBay sent me not only pointed it out to me in an email, he sent me a link to an article that was published by the Universal Ship Cancel Society. It's a 4-page article. He sent me a link to a PDF of it. And sure enough, this is almost identical to at least one of the covers that's illustrated in there. And it said it was made by A.C. Rossler. So it's a well-known forger that forged covers. And
But the extent of it.
Oh,
it had two British stamps.
It had
both of which had fake cancels.
Both of which had fake machine cancels. It had a U.S. stamp, which also had a fake machine had a fake duplex cancel because the killer part of the duplex was missing, and the killer part of the machine cancels for the British stamps were also missing.
Good grief!
And then it had a cachet on it.
It had cachets. Now the cachets might have been genuine. That's up for debate. What did he use as his source material? Did he use extra covers that hadn't been serviced and sold at the time, or were they just complete fabrications? That's up for debate. But the cover with the stamps on it, representing an actual collector having sent it and then being carried on the submarine and all of that, that much...
It was as fake as a $4 bill.
Yeah, there was too much of it had been changed.
I have a $4 bill.
And faked. So
I didn't say $3 bill because I know there had been a $3 bill. So now I'd say $4 bill.
So
was there a $4 bill?
The moral of the story is I pulled it off of eBay. Now I have to figure out what the fake is worth so I can list it as a fake and put it back up on eBay and sell it. So instead of being worth $100, it might be worth $20 or $30 or something like that. Because it's a well-done fake.
Because fakes, if you look at it from a standpoint of reperforating, I mean, it, just because you reperforate a stamp doesn't mean the stamp is valueless. It drops a lot of value. But it's still, you know, it regums stamps. People buy regum stamps because they may not be able to afford the ones with gum on them. So, you know, it's a way to get your album filled with real stamps. They just... are fake.
They're just altered.
They're altered, yeah.
That's funny though. You said that. Real stamps that are just fake.
Yeah.
Real stamps that are altered.
Well, how about like, there was an APS article a long time ago, and they were talking about regumming. And they were talking about regumming Colombian stamps. And said, wonder if you took gum and like mixed real gum that you got off a real 2-cent stamp. and you biffed it up with some extra gum, and then you put it on a $5 stamp. It's still original gum, but it's not original to that stamp.
Hmm.
And he compared it to automobiles, how you will have a Model T, but not all the parts are original to the car because they started remanufacturing Model T parts, you know, in the 1950s and continue to today.
So even though only the chassis might be original, it's still considered a Model T.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, I mean, any car, as it ages, parts wear out and you replace them mm-hmm. through the life of owning a car. And so does that make your car a fake then?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think the equivalent of that is a 245 is a 245 is a 245. It's just hasn't been altered.
Mm-hmm.
It just doesn't change that the stamp is real or not.
Well, lucky for you, I have three fake $5 Colombians.
Ooh.
All of them are used. Actually, I only have two. I sold one.
Oh.
You wouldn't hear something funny.
I traded it.
I bought a set of fake Colombians off eBay. And I paid for them, and the person never shipped them. And he probably looked at it and said, I'm not sending these to PSE. But whoever sold me those $5 that Colombian set and didn't send them, shame on you.
And for those,
because I really did want them.
And for those of you trying to buy a Model T's, you can buy every part for a Model T ever made brand new today, except the engine block.
Really?
Everyone.
You'd think that that would be a crucial part.
I'm sure 3D printing will.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, there you go. Yeah.
They just mastered the metal 3D printing.
They just printed an apartment building in China.
Yeah.
What?
You can 3D print pretty much anything now.
Yeah. I want a third kid. Can we 3D print one for me?
Yeah. Well, if you're going to 3D print a child, I'm going to have to ask you why, since we can currently manufacture them with unskilled labor.
Undocumented workers.
Wow. So,
anyway,
I said the labor could be unskilled. I didn't say it had to be unskilled.
Well, back to the subject of forgeries and fakes and all of that. I pulled a couple of books off of my shelves to bring to the table so that people could look at them. One of them is called Philatelic Forgers by Vero Tyler. Vero Tyler was a writer who was very interested in the lives and works of philatelic forgers. He wrote a number of books, including Focus on Forgeries for Linz. There's a multi-volume book called Album Weeds, which has been around for quite a while. And then there's also a forgery and reprint guide by Barefoot that was published by Barefoot, among others. These are just ones that I happen to be able to put my hands on in a couple of minutes.
Is Barefoot the name of a company or is it like an Indian?
Author's name?
No, Barefoot's a publishing company. They also published other philatelic works.
No, I never heard of them.
Well, I thought I was reading that pile wrong. It said weeds on it. I'm going, what weeds and stamps have to do with each other?
Well, if you have fakes in your, they're like having weeds in your garden.
It's a metaphor.
It's a metaphor.
Yeah, very famous. When were they written? The 1920s, 1930s?
Let's see here. What's the date on
this? So those are reprints of the original.
Yes, this is reprint. I actually have a two-volume original copy.
Are they still reprinting that today? I'll have to look into that.
I don't know if they're reprinting today. I don't see a date in here.
This
says third edition. This is a third edition reprint.
They started it a long time ago.
Maybe it's in volume one.
That might
could
be. Might be.
Well, the other one, too, if I remember correctly, there are no pictures. They describe the fake parts. Like, instead of showing you a top frame line has a gap in it, they will write the words, the top frame line has a gap in it. So it's kind of difficult to use sometimes, but overall, up to when it was written, it was a very a list of all the big fakes that were known, and there's a lot of them.
Well, there's also a lot of forgers that are well known, and I mean Sperati is one that is known, and the items that he faked and forged are well known and can bring nearly as much as genuine articles at times.
A U.S. number 2 Sperati fake is worth as much as a U.S. number 2 used.
Wasn't this something we were talking to Stanley about, and it royally pissed him off that some of these are worth more than their original counterparts?
Yeah.
Well, but they're also much, much rarer.
Oh.
And
they had one of these presses at the Uniplex show. Well,
you want to...
Europlex?
You know, J.W. Scott was actually considered a forger because he made all sorts of reprints of mostly locals.
Hmm.
But the U.S. locals, because there were lots of spaces in the albums, and since he was printing albums, he wanted people to be able to fill the spaces, so he decided to print these otherwise unobtainable stamps, and he made...
Well, it wasn't that they were unobtainable. It's just that it's so much easier to print your own Killaware than to find it.
That's true.
Yeah.
Another was S. Allen Taylor.
Mm-hmm.
Did a lot in the locals area.
He did a lot in a lot of areas, but
so was he faking? Yeah. Was he consider himself someone making facsimiles?
Actually,
or was it to deceive?
The good ones, they all considered themselves artists.
Yeah,
they were practicing their engraving.
Well, for many, many years, Scott actually used his own creations in his catalog as illustrations.
Yeah. Oh, no.
Yeah, that was up until, like, I think the 1970s. Somebody went through and said, okay, this picture's gone, this picture's gone.
Well, for many, many years, it was illegal to illustrate stamps. And so they had to use hand-drawn illustrations. And they couldn't be too accurate because the governments were afraid of stamps being forged. So that's one of the ways they got around it, is by doing hand drawings, line drawings, and changing certain items. And today you can find stamps that were forged based on the drawings from catalogs.
Yeah.
And that's one of the ways that we can use to identify those, because the research has been done and we know that this is how they differ from the genuine articles.
Well, one of the interesting laws is the Japanese counterfeiting and reproduction law. And they will make a very, very nice, very convincing fake, but they will alter the design just slightly.
Kind of like a signature?
And then what the fakers do who try to rob the collectors is they will put a cancel over the top of wherever it is. Like on the first issue, there's two dragons and they face each other.
Mm-hmm.
And between the two dragons, there's a little character that says fake or forged. I forget which one. And people will hit it with a canceling device right on that character, so it's hard to see. You look at it underneath a magnifying glass and you can find it, but you know, from just the naked eye, you may think it's a real stamp. So
some guy at a stamp show with poor lighting flipping through a book is just going to go, oh, cool, that's a good price.
Well, but the hitch is that everybody who collects Japanese stamps, if it has a cancel right there, they go,
nope,
pass.
Well, there's also a lot of U.S. newspaper stamps that are like that. They have the word facsimile or
false,
which is the German word for a fake. They have cancellations right over those markings as well.
And that's terrible because the word facsimile is so large that they take like a huge like ink smear.
I've seen some examples where it was actually scraped off.
Yeah, I've seen
and,
some.
Oh, wow. And it caused a thinning of the paper or a scuffing of the face of the stamp to get rid of that. And then they cancel over it. And you can kind of tell because it just looks wrong.
Hmm.
But otherwise, these stamps really look like the originals. They really have a high degree of artwork to them. They did a really good job.
Now, most of these things that we're talking about, though, are in the classic era of stamps. But that's not exclusive to that era. We have counterfeits all over the place today, even in the United States. There's a lot of stamp forgery going on. And if it looks too good to be true, it probably is when you go on eBay and, oh, look, I can get a whole pad of Forever stamps at 30% of face. Well, guess what?
No, that's a little different.
Those are probably not so good.
Yeah, let's bring up the Gandhi stamp from India. that's one that people are pouring out fakes now. You know, if you get a, it's very rare. Catalog's about $10,000.
Wow!
And you see them on eBay, and you know they'll start at something, and everybody goes fake. The other one that, and we discussed this one back when we were discussing perforations, is the OS Perfin of Australia, and the fakers are so good at it that it's almost impossible now to tell if it's a mint stamp, whether it's real, because all we're talking about there is punching a hole, and if you get the hole size correct and the position correct, you're stuck with trying to determine if it's real or not.
What about tagging? Aren't they having trouble reproducing tagging?
Oh, absolutely. That's something that adds a large cost to either the paper comes with it already mixed into the paper, or it's coated paper, or it's actually an ink that's applied. And all of those things increase the cost of materials far beyond what most forgers are willing to bother with. And the upside for the forger is usually you can't see it with the naked eye. And most people don't know about it, so they're not looking for it.
Well, that's what they're getting away with now in China.
I was curious what's going on in China.
You have stamps that were printed in the 1800s. They were printed in a relatively low-tech way.
Mm-hmm.
Nowadays, you're having high-tech printing. You know, they get micro print and things like that in the design. But, you know, the first six stamps of China are horribly, I shouldn't say horribly, they do an actually good job, but they are extensively faked.
Mm-hmm.
The number one way to tell a fake China number one through six, actually one through nine, is the quality of the paper. You can print the stamp, but you got to get the paper right.
Well,
that's the hard part.
That's true of a lot of fakes and forgeries. A lot of it's in the paper. It can be in the type of printing.
Watermarks.
But, yeah, watermarks. All these things that the governments have done to protect their stamps are ways that we can tell that things are not right when we look at a stamp. And so it's not that the fakers out there don't know about it. It's that nobody ever checks except when you kind of get it into the collecting area. I mean, you have postal inspectors out there that do chase after it. They do find these things. It's just like fake money. It occurs, and they go after it, and they find the guys that are doing it, and they put them out of business and put them behind bars. But sometimes it takes a while. Mm-hmm. And part of that is because the public is completely unaware that this is going on.
Well, that's when you're ripping off a government. If you rip off Joe Stamp Collector, first of all, he may not even know he's been ripped off.
Well, that's generally the case, he doesn't know he's been ripped off. And some of these famous forgers went on for years ripping off collectors. Mm-hmm. And the governments didn't care because it was one or two collectors, and the guy's a crackpot. Yeah, but the guy...
Well, the other thing is, like, you know, Sparati, I believe he was in either France or Spain or flipped between the two.
I believe he was Italian and he lived in France.
Okay. So it was France. So, you know, you get a fake in New York City and you go to the New York cops and say, hey, look what somebody just stole me. They're not going to send some dude over to France to arrest the guy.
Unless it's a U.S. stamp, but most of the time it wasn't.
Yeah.
Usually for the government to pursue it, it has to be for a significantly large amount of money for them to bother with it, too.
Well, I believe that Sparati only did one U.S. stamp, and that was U.S. number two. Am I correct? No, he did one.
He also did 9X1.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
But both
New York Postmaster Provisional.
But both of those stamps, now that you say it, I do know that that's correct. Neither one were valid for postage.
At the time he did them, no.
Yeah, so that may be... I mean, he appeared to have been a very smart person in that the things that he did as his art were not things that could come back
when they actually caught him and confiscated his stock and all of that. They discovered numerous items that they didn't even know that he had forged.
Yeah.
and multiple, and most of the stuff that he made, he didn't make that many copies of. Same thing with a lot of forgers. They did one-offs and, you know, 2, 5, 10 of an item, and then that was it.
Yeah. If you look at his...
the ones that were really good.
Yeah. But if you look at his work, if I recall, percentage-wise, it was probably like 5%, but he did a lot of stamps of Uruguay.
And
it's
what?
Like, who's, you know, who's
going to... Are there valuable Uruguay stamps?
Well, yes, and... But who's going to be out there, you know, worrying about the Uruguay stamp market?
Apparently he was.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, they had a Sperati press on exhibit at Eurofilex. That's what Jessica was talking about, and that was a one-off machine.
My favorite.
He was never
brand
mass producing them. So I'm asking this question because I'm hoping there are multiple answers to it besides the obvious. Why are some of these things faked?
Almost always for money, obviously.
Well, that's the obvious main reason. Were there other reasons?
If you ask Sperati, he was doing it as art.
Because he could.
Yeah.
Because I know people will alter coils simply because they have the $5 version. They're not going to be able to afford the $500 version.
Yeah.
And it becomes a placeholder.
Yeah. That was actually common in the probably in the 30s and 40s when during the Depression era, there were a lot of collectors that were what we would call garbage can collectors. They basically pulled the used envelopes out of the mail and soaked the stamps off. And these collectors, a lot of times, amassed large quantities and very nice collections, but there would be certain stamps that they could not get, really rare coils and things like that. So they would take a sheet stamp and trim off perforations to make stamps that looked right, knowing full well that they were right, and they put them in their album to fill a space.
I
still see them. From time to time, when I look at old time collections, well, this is my great grandfather's. He started it, and my grandfather continued it, and these stamps were in there, and they got to be worth a lot of money because that's what the catalog says. And you look at it, and you go, "Sorry."
Those are the ones that get the most offended when you point it out too, because now you're dishonoring their family name.
I remember personally.
But really, he couldn't afford it, and he was just trying to fill a space. It was his hobby.
Yep.
I remember personally cutting stamps off a coil and sticking it in my album. I didn't do it to rip anybody off. You know, there was sort of that thing of thinking of a 10-year-old where, ooh, I just made a $500 stamp and then stuck it in my album. But there's probably cash fakes out there somewhere.
Well,
unless
you
somebody
knew,
threw them away.
You knew what you were doing. That's innocent. Then it leaks out when somebody else gets a hold of that album and that stamp, and then they try to pass it off because they genuinely think it's legitimate.
Well, that's the thing that I tell everybody is the reason why you need to get your coil stamps authenticated is because if a 10-year-old can fake it,
ugh, good point.
You need to get a certificate.
Protect yourself from 10-year-olds.
Yeah.
Well, the thing with coils was, when they first came out, they weren't collected because they were not considered – they were considered damaged stamps. They didn't have perforations on all the sides. So they were kind of shunned. And then when people started realizing that, no, these are really separate issues, then they started to collect them. And then they had to go back and fill in the ones that they missed because they didn't realize it. And then
– well, there was a period, a short period where people – collected straight edges.
Well, they still do in Europe.
Yeah.
I've bought a number of collections.
Oh, Sweden, big time. They list them in the catalog and everything.
Well, really? Yeah, Sweden. Yeah. But I've got other countries, Germany and such, that, hey, if it came in a booklet and it came in a sheet, then I have the booklet and I have the sheet.
Because
the sheets didn't have any straight edges. And here's a straight edge stamp. Obviously, it has to be from a booklet.
If you look at... a lot of the issues, and I brought up Sweden, but they'll have a stamp, and it'll come in three varieties. And it'll come as a sheet stamp with four sides of perforations. It'll come with three sides of perforations.
From a booklet?
Yeah. Then underneath it, it'll have a sub-variety where it'll have two sides of perforations. And then the third one will be a coil.
Yeah, because you can get a corner out of a booklet, too.
Yeah.
Oh, that's true.
Well, so, a lot of those listings are two or three sides because it's either one's the booklet.
Well, yeah, but if you
look, some collections will have both.
Well, if you look in the catalogs, the facets and the stuff like that, if you look in Scott's, there will be a footnote on some of them maybe, or it'll just say three or four. But people don't realize that the difference in value between three perforated sides and four perforated sides could be four, five, six times catalog value.
Yeah.
So does anybody have any favorites? I've got a couple.
Oh, so well, do I.
Mine so far are the C3As that we see. Just because as soon as it comes in, you go, oh, that's cute. Not a chance, sorry. But then you get to see how good or poor the work is, and one of the best ones I've seen so far was a C3A that came through here.
Oh,
that was done very well. I know you guys know which one I'm talking about.
We put it in the Book of Secrets, too. We were so impressed by it. Yeah.
They took two real C3s, sliced them apart microscopically between the layers, and then inverted one of the planes, stuck it back in another one, and did such a good job of refeathering the fibers together, it was almost impossible to tell.
Almost.
Almost.
That was a great one.
I recall a Pan Am, I think it was a 1 cent invert, and I remember looking at that, and this was, had to be close to 10 years ago, and a number of the senior experts looked at it and said, oh, it's genuine, it's genuine. And I said, well, I don't know. I'm going to put this under ultraviolet light and put it in the VSC, and I'm going to check it all out. And I stuck it in there, and the thing lit up like a Christmas tree.
Nice.
All the adhesive that they had used, they had done exactly what you were describing with the C3A. They'd shaved two stamps and then put the center from one onto the frame of the other. But they hadn't done a good job with the adhesive. Mm. And the adhesive had different reflective properties than the paper. And so you could see the oval right around the vignette where they had oopsed on the gum or adhesive to attach the two pieces together.
Well, my favorite forgery is the same. It's a C3A with the upside-down plane. But the guy, the pilot, is hanging out of it because he fell out of the pilot seat.
I've seen that one. No good grief.
Well, I have a large collection or accumulation of fake Zululand overprints, and my favorite is a guy just put a stamp in his typewriter and typed Zululand on a British stamp.
That's pretty bad. How did he even get it to fit? That's quite a big
word. It was a
word.
Used stamp, so he probably glued it to a piece of typing paper or just stuck the envelope in and typed Zululand on it. It was careful to put a capital Z, small U, small L, small U.
That's cute. Yeah, we found some. I've seen some come through here. Another one of the inverts. It was 290-something. I can't remember which one it was. But it was a specimen. And somebody had very carefully laid a cancel on top of the word specimen to try to hide it.
That's the one that Dave Hester liked.
Yeah, that's right. We showed that one to Dave.
Now we did have an episode where we talked about Kansas, Nebraska fake overprints. So we have touched on this before.
Yeah, that can't possibly be anybody's favorite stamp, though.
My favorites are the Kansas, Nebraska overprints on Prexies.
Oh.
Well, the inverts are pretty much fun too, since they couldn't possibly exist.
Yeah.
Next week, we will be joined by the world-renowned stamp expert, author, and collector John Hotchner to discuss the history of the U.S. postal counterfeits, those made specifically to bypass the government.
Stop. We have to re-record that. Take out U.S., please. It's not U.S. It's postal counterfeits.
Oh, okay. Okay. Yeah, somewhere it got typed in there as
yeah,
U.S.
We also need to do an inverted Jenny before you close.
Oh, yeah, I'm going to
no,
do
go
that
ahead
next.
And do that.
I just want to give a preview.
But, yeah, you need to take the U.S. out.
Okay.
Maybe we could add in there. Do you know the difference between a copy and a replica?
Uh-oh, that's a good question. What?
A copy is a copy made by anybody. A replica is a copy by the person who did the original.
Oh, good point.
Okay, so next week, a little preview. We will be joined by the world-renowned stamp expert, author, and collector John Hotchner, to discuss the history of postal counterfeits, those made specifically to bypass the government. Dun, dun, dun.
Dun, dun, dun.
Excellent.
So can we get a drum roll for our Jenny sheet, please?
I'm running out of these guys. I think I'm going to have to...
We're going to have to print up some more.
Yeah, well, this right here, I mean...
How many of those have we gone through?
I guess we've gone through about
30
of them 30? Or so, yeah.
Yeah, we started that pretty early, like episode 2 or 3.
We need to order another 10,000.
This is depressing that after opening 30 of these, I haven't found a $50,000 stamp.
Well, maybe by episode 8,552.
And it is... it's a regular 12 bucks worth of
it. I
can tell you exactly why you haven't found a $50,000 sheet. It's because it's hiding in the bunch that I have in my house.
Wow, he did get excited there for a second. He opened that upside down.
That was funny.
Okay, you can email us at stampshowheretoday@gmail.com, Twitter at stampshowht, Facebook, Stamp Show Here Today, and our website, www.stampshowheretoday.com, with your questions and comments. You can now leave us your questions and comments in Google Voice answering machine anytime. The number is country code 949-873-4298. There's also a link to a Google Voice on our website so you can make a call from your computer. And on that note, keep collecting.
Narwhals.
Narwhals.
Thank you for sharing.
I'm James Wygant, Associate Editor of the American Stamp Dealer and Collector, and you're listening to Stamp Show Here Today.
This episode of Stamp Show Here Today is brought to you by the Philatelic Book of Secrets, the book that teaches you about repurse, regums, color varieties, and much more. Get yours for $10 at www.philatelicsecrets.com today. She wrote upon it. We turn.